Welcome back to another 15 Minutes with Mark Wade. I'm Daphna.
I am Mark Wade, Editor-in-Chief of Boom Studios, and today we are taking more questions out of the hat.
Yes, and this one is from the bullpen, from Ian.
Why do you think it's from Ian? Is it because it's about Doctor Who? Is that why you think
No, that's not the one I'm reading, but I know this one's in the same email.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Don't question my process.
All right.
I did a hand movement. Why did that happen?
I don't know.
What was it like starting as a comics journalist for Amazing Heroes, and how does it affect the way you deal with the comics press now as a creator?
I am much kinder now. It's like the difference between people who were never a waiter and people who were a waiter. Like, they leave better tips. When I first started, actually, I didn't start editorially. I started in the industry press. I started working for Amazing Heroes, which was the Wizard magazine of its day. Except with fewer boobs, and take that however you want. And that involved a lot of calling editors and calling writers and talking to them about what their upcoming plans were, and that sort of really helped me get a foothold in comics because I get to know these people and I get to talk to editors and establish a relationship by which they can then pitch stories or talk about, or, you know, talk about. I'm sure I was an obnoxious fan in many ways. I'm sure that I graduated from that into editorial when I took an editorial job at Amazing Heroes, having gone from freelance and then left from there to go to DC as an editor. So my time in the industry, trenches was not huge, but I learned a lot. I mean, I learned that, first off, you know, comic book people are just people. I mean, they're not, you know, when you first start to talk to them, they're like your gods. Mm-hmm. They're like sports heroes or whatever. They're like, you know, and I've always said, and this is the God's honest truth, our TV friends serve us best on TV, which is to say, be careful when you meet the people who you admire, because sometimes they're best left over there where you can't actually interact
with them.
You
really just don't want to see them go to the bathroom.
Or you don't want to hear them really have a conversation with you because you find out that they're not quite the sweet people that you want them to be. In comics, that was generally not the case. There were a couple who were a little testy. There was one writer who will go unnamed who I spoke with at great length about his plans for an upcoming series. And he was very forthcoming and very pleasant, and he was one of my favorite writers, so that really helped. I mean, he was one of my favorite writers growing up, and he talked to me at enormous length about his plans for his series. And then 6 months later, I called him up to make a follow-up, and he didn't remember who it was that he talked to last time. He just remembered it was somebody from my magazine. He didn't remember it was me. And he spent the first 10 minutes just being angry and vitriolic about the last jerk who called him, because he was taking all this stuff that was off the record and putting it in the article, and he spoiled everything, and I can't say to him,
That was me,
and by the way...
That's beautiful, actually.
I know, and by the way, you said no such thing about it being off the record, so I didn't say that. So anyway, but you learn. I mean, you and basically, I think the most important difference, I just try to make room now for interviews, try to make room for, well, that should come as no surprise. I mean, I don't think that you can go anywhere on the comics internet without finding 18 interviews with me, because apparently I won't shut up. But I just know they've got their jobs to do, and I know that it is not easy getting people on the record, and it is not easy getting people to talk about what they want to, like, really talk about stuff. My disappointment with comics journalism, such as it is, and I was guilty of this to some degree too, is that a lot of the interviews I do still do are very much like Mad Libs interviews. They feel like there have been more than once where I freely admit that I have just cut and pasted an answer sometimes, because it's always like, so tell us about where you came up with the inspiration for Irredeemable. Oh, look, that's question 8B. Look, and I understand that you need to lay this groundwork, but boy, every once in a while somebody will come along and ask me like Warren Ellis did an interview with me once, but I mean, he was a pro at that point too, but he did an interview with me once that was a lot more about process and a lot more about my feelings about stuff, and it was a lot less about what's happening in next month's issue of Justice League or whatever, and it was more fun to do that interview.
Do you think a lot of the reason why that's becoming more and more prevalent is the preponderance of email interviews?
Yes.
That it's less talking on the phone, so you can't build that rapport, you can't do the follow-up question.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, because I remember when I was working at EW, and I'd like do an email question and not followed by phone, like you just, it's a completely different feeling.
And I'm torn because on the one hand, I tend to prefer email interviews because
it gives you time to think.
It gives me time to think. It gives me time to be a little more eloquent than I am.
Pronounce words correctly.
Exactly. Or at the very least, not say and ons. Oh, that's your problem. And not stutter and stammer all the way through and not repeat myself. The downside to that, of course, is that, and I say this with all due respect to the fine comics journalists out there working.
But there's no time sometimes. Well, especially like different time zones and countries.
Yeah, but that's not my beef. My beef is I'm basically doing your job. Because your job is to type, you know, how long does it take to type up 10 questions about Irredeemable? And yet, I'm the guy who's sitting there actually writing out the answers, which you will then just take and cut and paste into your website. And I'm not complaining exactly because I don't know any way around that. And I've already said I prefer that to the phone interviews most of the time. But I wish there were some sort of happy medium where because it...
Chat?
But again, yeah, actually, those are actually some of the best ones.
You've done a few? I didn't know. I don't know if it's been... Oh, cool.
And actually, I like those because it gives me a chance to be fairly eloquent in as I am, and more so in typing, as you can tell, than in actual speaking. But the questions are a little more lively. There's a little more vitality to the whole process. But I don't do that as much.
And they're emoticons.
I don't... Emoticons are for the literally...
That's not even a word.
Yes!
You win.
The
scoreboard's Mark 2000, Daphne 1. Actually, it's taking me out of the negative, so I'm back to zero.
That's true. I'm
literally
emoticons. Shut up. Emoticons. Emoticons are for the reason I mispronounced the word is because I'm struggling to try to find a word that you won't edit out.
Express your proper vehemence for the emoticons.
Vehemence. Ah, see, look at that.
Look, back to zero.
You're back to zero.
Thanks.
Yes.
Thanks.
So
let me have it for a total of what? 10 seconds.
Enjoy. Just savor that 10 seconds. Emoticons. No. I just, even today when I write text, I write, you know, I spell out all my words and I use punctuation. I'm spell check. Exactly.
Because if you don't, yeah. I mean, I read those emails as a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I'll read it as like a grown man.
Yeah.
And it'll be like if the I is not capitalized or something, I'll be like, cute little 13-year-old girl going to the mall.
How
sweet.
No.
Maybe I should text my answer in response with no vowels.
I know. You know, if you're a grown man over the age of say 35, you don't need to be using the numbers 2 and 4 to spell out your words for you. It's just too precious. So that was, you know, I don't know if we really kind of got an answer to the question, but it was that I've certainly learned to be kinder and more tolerant and more patient with those guys who come from the trenches because I dig what they're trying to do, you know.
Are you more aware of things you can't say because you know what you would latch onto?
Yes. Yes, I am very aware. Well, you would think, and yet as we've seen repeatedly, that apparently...
You like to talk.
Apparently I like to talk, and apparently there's nothing I won't say if you catch me at the right moment. So, which is why Ross lives in a perpetual state of terror about these podcasts. But, yeah, I'm a little more aware of the kind of things that you can't... A little more savvy about how to manipulate the answers and manipulate the questions. But the other side of that is I think I'm actually a really good interview because if you're a neophyte, instead of being impatient with you, I'll walk you through it. Like I'm good at sound bites. I'm really good at the sound bites and the call out quotes and that, you know, if you're fairly new at this and nervous, trust me, you're in good hands. We'll go.
You're in good hands never sounds not creepy. I'm sorry, Mark.
Oh man. Was it the Doctor Who one?
Let's do the Doctor Who one. Okay. Also from Ian, because anything Doctor Who in this office
is automatically
Ian. Okay. He wants to know how you discovered Doctor Who, and you claim that it made you a better writer. And also Russell T. Davies has a writer's tale, and it's... Wait, you said that Russell T. Davies' writer's tale is one of the best books about writing you've ever read.
Ever.
I have to, like, change all the he's to use.
Ah, I got it. Okay, yeah.
Give me a second. And just because this is funny, because he always has this, I have it in my car if you need it. So I've got it in my hand.
Right. In case I didn't remember what my favorite kind of book about writing
I've got a Star Trek library in my car, and he's got Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's good if you
could... And we live in the same apartment. And when we park in the same parking lot, we just open the back of our cars and have a little library.
That's sweet. A little lit fair. A little street fair. I discovered... I never watched Doctor Who when I was a kid. All I knew was it was that weird, quirky show about the guy with the scarf that's on, you know, PBS. And in terms of conventions, especially at the Dallas conventions that I went to when I was a kid, I was always a big Doctor Who contingent. And in terms of like the sort of fanboy hierarchy, the Doctor Who guys were at the absolute bottom. Like, they were the guys that the comic book people like me made fun of. So, because you're in your scarf and your trench coat and your hat, and it's Dallas, and it's 95 degrees with 98% humidity, and so you look like a melted wax statue. But
especially if they have the wig.
Yeah, kudos to you. But so I made fun and I mocked and so forth. And then they started up the new Doctor Who series on BBC. And John Rogers, creator of Blue Beetle and a creator of the TV show Leverage and a good friend of mine and a good friend of Boom's, gave me the first 13 episodes to watch. And I sat on them for a long time because I love John like a brother. He's one of my favorite people in this world. I would take a bullet for John. And yet, John's and my taste do not always line up beautifully. John, to this day, thinks The Rundown is the greatest movie of all time. And
there are, and Mark bites his tongue when he hears that.
That was what it was. When he made us all see
Down with Love.
Down with Love. John. So
he's
not
as enamored with Ewan McGregor.
Charming
man.
So we're coming up to some party or something. I got to see John that night. And I'm like, well, all right, I'll watch the first 5 minutes of the first one just so I can say I saw it and we can have something and I can then steer the conversation onto something else John loves, like The Rundown or Down by Love, Down with Love. And I put it in. It's like Saturday morning. I put in the first episode. 12 hours later, I got out of my chair.
I know that feeling.
It was so mind-blowingly great. From the moment the characters show up on screen, I am drawn in. I love the fact that the very first thing that Doctor Who says to Rose, do you remember? Mm-hmm. And it sets the tone for the whole series. His first word to her is run.
Yes.
And that's what they do. And it is, the plotting was excellent. The dialogue was great. The characters were funny. The threats were genuine.
Yeah, the mix of like irreverent humor and the fact that when someone gets shot in the face, you know they got shot in the face.
Yeah,
but terrifying.
But so what I learned as I'm watching this thing is that the mastermind behind this is a guy named Russell Davis, who is a Brit writer who had done other stuff I liked. I mean, he did a series called Bob and Rose, which I kind of liked, and he'd done a few other things which I was a big fan of. So I didn't realize it was the same guy. I was watching Doctor Who. I'm enamored with this. And structurally, the plotting of it was just like a Swiss watch. The characters were great. But most importantly, what it made me a better writer. In that 12 hours, I've never had, at least in my adult life, I don't think I've ever had an experience in that compressed a time, like 12 hours, where I came out of it as if I'd gone to some life-changing seminar or some sort of workshop with some great authors of history or something. I really feel like I came out of there a much better writer because it got me it recharged my batteries in terms of how to balance humor and horror, which is something I think I do pretty well. That notion that you can bob along and be having fun, and all of a sudden you can turn the page and
well, how do you sell the horror if you don't know what you're losing?
Right. Well, true. And you also, but it's a tough balance because people are afraid, especially with horror, people are afraid to make stuff too funny because they don't know how to balance the light and the dark. Russell Davis does that beautifully, and his writers did that beautifully. The other thing that he did that I thought was phenomenal, and it really showed up in like second season stuff, because we're 4 seasons in now, mm-hmm. Doctor. Okay, so the second season, there was a brilliant episode called The Impossible Planet, where, and I forget the second part title. The one with the devil one, the one where they
where the devil's in the planet.
Yeah.
And he looks in and he sees the face.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
what they've done in that, if you look structurally at that episode, it is a thing of beauty because what the writers do is they take 3 sets of characters. They basically have a big cast. They get Doctor Who and Rose and
people
a bunch
on the
of
ship.
People on the ship.
Yeah.
What they do is they're facing this big calamity, but they face it on several different ground. Like there's things attacking the spaceship. There's things underground they've got to investigate, and there's something else going on over here.
And they're all infighting.
So what they do is they split the group into teams of 3, and I've never quite seen anything like this so eloquent. What they did is they kept intercutting between each group's quest and it was like biorhythms. It was like as one group would start to fail at something, you cut to one of the other groups that started to succeed at something. And then you cut back to the third group that started to succeed at something. You cut back to another group that started to fail. Mm-hmm. And it was like a constant sense of tension because you get three times the bang in terms of the dramatic rises and falls because of all the quick cutting. It was, and how to tell complete done in one stories
with a huge cast, introducing new characters, making them emotionally relevant, so when you kill them off,
right,
it hits,
and making you yeah. care about whatever yeah. the quest is in that particular episode, and yet also giving it an overarching story arc for the main characters as well as just the individual done in one parts. That's just genius, and that's very much what we do in comics if we do it right. Which is, I really like as much as I can to make every individual issue of a comic book a sort of a discrete unit of entertainment, if you will. I know that sounds very clinical, but something where there is a conflict and a resolution within that 22 pages, even if it's still part of a longer story. So, Doctor Who and Russell Davis, who wrote this amazing book, is my favorite.
I'll link to it on Amazon.
It's my favorite book on writing that I've read in forever. It is called The Writer's Tale. And what it is during the development of the most recent season, a magazine writer had gotten a hold of Russell Davis and said, well, I want to do a series of email interviews with you to create a magazine article about the process of the year and sort of the ground zero, sort of here's what it's like to be here at the, you know, at the beginning of the series and watching you construct it. And what this turned into was an exchange of emails back and forth between the journalist and Russell that got bigger and bigger and longer and longer. Now it's this giant, thick, huge book that is like a year's exchange of emails. And it's a great distillation of process. What I love about it is Russell will write this huge email about how, here's the problem I had with last night's episode as I was trying to script it, and here's how I cracked the problem. And then the next page will be the email from the next day that says, okay, that solution didn't work, and and here's why it didn't work, as I realized and as I slept on it, and now here's my new solution. And it's just, that's what we do as writers all the time, but it's great to watch him solve his problems and see how, and explain how he solves his problems. I picked up a bunch of stuff from it, just in terms of how to look at your stories, how to remember stuff, how to
analyze after the fact.
Yeah, and how to remember, just what to remember as you write. There are some beautiful, beautiful pieces of advice in there, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's listening and wants to write. You kind of have to watch this fourth season of Doctor Who before you read it, or else it's full of spoilers. But even if you haven't done that, it's still a good tome to read from. And I guess that wraps it up for this time. So thanks for joining us. I will be back with my Singapore convention report next week. And we will talk then.
Yeah, and check out the blog for links to what was discussed in this podcast.